Commander-in-Chief of the US military, and a man that just 4 years ago took a pledge echoed by his forefathers to uphold the law and constitution of the United States of America, and a man that wanted to continue for another 4 years. With Trump essentially asking the Secretary of State for Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, to break the law and find nearly 12,000 votes, the prompt reply from the official was clear. Georgia's results are correct. Trump then went on to explain that voter fraud was a serious crime, and then had the audacity to threaten the official by claiming he was taking a huge risk by breaking the law. Irony at its very finest, it seems.
The ballots are corrupt, and you're going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them, because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk.
Is Trump then breaking the law himself by asking for votes to be found?
I think it is a criminal activity. I think he was clearly pressing an a government official to alter the vote count. That would be illegal under federal law and also under Georgia state law. And the United States says the national laws and the state laws. What are the chances of the federal law being applied to him? Trump can, of course, give himself a blanket pardon for just about everything. He probably will.
Since the election results were announced, Donald Trump has been contesting the figures and making unsubstantiated allegations of electoral fraud, much of which he believes comes from the postal votes cast by voters worried about voting in person due to the COVID-19 virus.
It's essentially if they did this, which we have no proof of. We have claim after claim after claim with zero proof. Zero.
Trump's behavior has sparked an angry reaction from multiple leading officials, most notably 10 previous defense secretaries of both Republican and Democrat views, who have urged Trump to drop the notion that the election was not fair and accept defeat with grace. Some of Trump's most staunch supporters, however, have continued to attempt to override the decision, with the likes of Ted Cruz and 10 other senators trying to get Congress to reject the clarification of the result due on the 6th of January. Yet even this is being met by resistance from other leading Republicans. Donald Trump has made it no secret of his clear distaste for Iran. The reason? Simply because Iran chose not to conform with the so-called American way, and hence saw the president remove the US from the JCPOA, assassinate Iran's leading military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and place sanctions on Iran that constituted nothing short of economic terrorism. Along with his ailing ally Benjamin Netanyahu, the Trump and Israeli regime have longed to start a conflict with Iran, in particular over the last 4 years with Trump as president. But as his time comes to an end, will Trump use a conflict with Iran in a last-ditch effort to stay in power, a move that would still guarantee nothing?
Well, I don't think so. Trump is a very erratic figure, though. I've been hearing that there's imminent war with Iran for 10, 15 years now, and there have been some nasty acts about that, the sanctions, assassinations. But a full attack on Iran, I don't think Trump will do that. There's too much headwind from the Joint Chiefs, the generals and the admirals. They don't want it.
Yet the U.S. military themselves are very wary about possible actions and decisions taken by Trump, with the same 10 former defense secretaries who told Trump to accept the election result also stating that entering the U.S. armed forces into a military dispute would be dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional. For Iran, however, the departure of Trump spells a victory and an embarrassing defeat for Trump, as the nation stood firmly against the maximum pressure policy, overcame sanctions through national unity and production, and saw leaders, such as Lieutenant General Soleimani, successfully defeat the US-backed Daesh group, paving the way for a retreat of US forces in the region. With Trump having shown throughout his term the ability to make and act on so many irrational decisions, it appears that the 45th President of the United States is truly on the edge of reason and about to leave a legacy of nothing but lies, deceit, and humiliation.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thanks to new research by an international team of astronomers, the oldest and most distant galaxy observed in our universe to date, known as GNZ-11, has been identified. We're prepared for you an article written by StarPup, Science Alert website. The piece is titled, Astronomers Find Oldest, Most Distant Galaxy to Date. Please stay with us for more. Since time immemorial, philosophers and scholars have contemplated the beginning of time and even tried to determine when all things began. It's only been in the age of modern astronomy that we've come close to answering that question with a fair degree of certainty. According to the most widely accepted cosmological models, the universe began with the Big Bang roughly 13.8 billion years ago. Even so, astronomers are still uncertain about what the early universe looked like, since this period coincided with the cosmic dark ages. Therefore, astronomers keep pushing the limits of their instruments to see when the earliest galaxies formed. Thanks to new research by an international team of astronomers, the oldest and most distant galaxy observed in our universe to date, known as GNZ-11, has been identified. The team, whose research was recently published in the journal Nature Astronomy, was led by Linhua Jiang of the Kavli Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics and Professor Nobunari Kashikawa of the University of Tokyo in Japan. They were joined by researchers from the observatories of the Carnegie Institution for Science, the Stewart Observatory, and the Geneva Observatory, Peking University in China, and the University of Tokyo in Japan. Simply put, the cosmic dark ages began about 370,000 years after the Big Bang and continued for another 1 billion years. At this time, the only light sources were either the photons released before, which is still detectable today as the cosmic microwave background radiation, and those released by neutral hydrogen atoms. The light of these photons is so shifted due to the expansion of the universe that they are invisible to us today. This effect is known as red shift, where the wavelength of light is elongated or shifted towards the red end of the spectrum as it passes through the ever-expanding cosmos on its way to reach us. For objects moving closer to our galaxy, the effect is reversed, with the wavelength shortening and shifting towards the blue end of the spectrum. For nearly a century, astronomers have used these effects to determine the distance of galaxies and the rate at which the universe is expanding. In this case, the research team used the Keck 1 telescope at Mauna Kea in Hawaii to measure the red shift of GNZ11 to determine its distance. The results they obtained indicated that is the furthest and oldest galaxy ever observed. As Kashikawa explained in a University of Tokyo press release, from previous studies, the galaxy GNZ11 seems to be the furthest detectable galaxy from us at 13.4 billion light-years away, or 134 non-Elion kilometers. That's 134 followed by 30 zeros. But measuring and verifying such a distance is not an easy task. Specifically, the team examined the carbon emission lines coming from GNZ11, which were in the ultraviolet range when they left the galaxy and were shifted by a factor of 10, to the infrared 0.2 micrometers by the time it reached Earth. This level of redshift indicates that this galaxy existed as observed roughly 13.4 billion years ago, also known as just 400 million years after the Big Bang. At this distance, GNZ11 is so far that it defines the very boundary of the observable universe itself. Whilst this galaxy has been observed in the past by Hubble, it took the resolving power and spectroscopic capabilities of the Keck Observatory to make accurate measurements of its distance. This was performed as part of the Multi-Object Spectrograph for Infrared Exploration, or MOSFIRE survey, which captured the emission lines from GNZ11 in detail. This allowed the team of scientists to produce distance estimates for this galaxy that were improved by a factor of 100 over any measurements that were previously made. Professor Kashikawa said, "The Hubble Space Telescope detected the signature multiple times in the spectrum of GNZ11. However, even the Hubble cannot resolve ultraviolet emission lines to the degree we needed, so we turned to a more up-to-date ground-based spectrograph, an instrument to measure emission lines called MOSFIRE, which is mounted to the Keck 1 telescope in Mauna Kea in Hawaii." If subsequent observations can confirm the result of this latest study, then the astronomers can say with certainty that GNZ11 is the furthest galaxy ever observed. Through the study of objects like this one, astronomers hope to be able to shed light on a period of cosmic history when the universe was just a few hundred millions of years old. This period coincides with the universe was beginning to emerge from the Dark Ages, when the first stars and galaxies formed and filled the early universe with visible light. By studying these, astronomers hope to learn more about how the large-scale structures of the universe subsequently evolved. This will be assisted by next-generation telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, scheduled to launch on 31st of October 2021. These instruments will even allow astronomers to be able to study the Dark Ages itself, a time when the only non-CMB light was the spin line of neutral hydrogen in the far microwave wavelength of 21 centimeters. To be able to probe the very beginnings of the universe itself and watch as the first stars and galaxies form, what an exciting time that will be! The observations that made this research possible were conducted under a time exchange program between the Keck Observatory and the Subaru Telescope on Mount Mauna Kea in Hawaii.
Around the World with Reporters.
The parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen's Marib have halted the process of 10 prisoner swap deals that would release more than 300 prisoners from both sides. The exchange was a part of an agreement reached recently between the warring local parties. An official of the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs blames the mercenaries for the halt.
When tribal mediators are involved in the release of the prisoners, the mercenaries stop them. This is also true about these exchanges that include more than 300 prisoners. The mercenaries are not one party, but rather they are several parties. And whenever we agree with one party, the other side fails it.
This comes while the Yemeni army has made significant achievements in advancing towards the city of Marib to liberate it. Halting the prisoner swap will put more pressure on the Yemeni army to stop the advance of coalition forces on the ground.
The coalition forces play several cards to stop the army's advance toward Marib in order to win a battle that will liberate the city. Halting the prisoner exchange is one of those. This is another effort by Saudi-led coalition to pressure the Yemeni army.
The prisoners' committee was able to liberate hundreds of prisoners during 2020 through local negotiations without any international mediation. However, the Saudi-led coalition seeks to stop the humanitarian process.
Thousands of Yemenis are still in prisons waiting for the United Nations to stop the delays in the release and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to commit to its obligation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Panis Plexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PONIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds.
Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
For refugees in reception camps in Greece, it has been a year of fires, double displacement, and now COVID-19. With rolling lockdowns enforced since March, along with restrictions that have only served to make unbearable living conditions even worse. In response to this, independent groups have sprung up and are trying to make a difference. Yellow Days is one of them, empowering forced migrants and changing the narrative surrounding their circumstances lies at the heart of everything they do. The friendships forged during Yellow Days festivals have lasted, and although COVID-19 prevented them from getting together in 2020, the team is still busy making magic happen online.
We have this, you know, distortionate idea of feeling that the refugee community has poor people, they're waiting to be helped, they're just depressed and waiting for answers, and it's far from the reality that I have experienced, especially with all my forced migrant friends. They're people that are active, they're people with loads of skill, power and talent, and all that we do at the Yellow Days is bring all those people together.
Yellow Days is run by a core group of 8 women, which members say is one of its most important aspects. One of the primary goals of groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race.
Because our system of capitalism and white supremacy, what we definitely know is that we can't rely on governments to help, and the media propaganda machine is so well-financed and consistent that we are lacking not just political will but also human will. And I think this isn't really a time this year with COVID and 2020, this has also been a time for people to start waking up to their own power.
The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei has stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind a recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies.
He has stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability, like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughing stock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has finally declared there will be an orderly transition of power. The news comes after violence in the nation's capital as Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building while lawmakers met to certify President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. World leaders joined the chorus of outrage condemning the outgoing president for stoking the unrest. For weeks he undermined the result, claiming election fraud, and then rallied protesters to head to the Capitol. As angry demonstrators stormed Congress, one woman was shot dead by police and three others died of, quote, medical emergencies. An improvised explosive device was also intercepted by authorities. As the situation deteriorated, fellow Republicans urged Trump to call his protest off. Hours later, he posted a video reiterating his claims of fraud. He also cheered his supporters, saying he loved them and described them as special, but called on them to remain calm and return home. In an unprecedented step, Twitter took down the video and suspended his account, threatening permanent suspension if he continued to violate the social media platform. President of the European Council, Charles Michel, took to Twitter to voice his concerns. He joined world leaders calling for a peaceful transfer of power. Earlier, UK Home Secretary Priti Patel was asked about Trump's role in stoking anger and mistrust in the electoral process.
We've just seen, you know, confidence in democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display, and people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, you know, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States, for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal: to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims. Like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only four. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal.
While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, the hunt for those culpable in Fakhrizadeh assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An official ceremony was held at the Assad House for Art and Culture in Damascus, marking the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria delivered a word condemning the assassination crime and asserting that the Iranian people have taken revenge and continue to do so. He also reiterated his country's ongoing support to the Syrian people and army until the full defeat of terror.
The criminal act perpetrated by the U.S. administration is against all international laws and the U.N. Charter. It is an act rejected by the entire world. The assassination proves the failure of the aggressive plot aimed at supporting terrorism and spreading instability in this region.
The event was attended by a wide range of high-ranking officials. Dr. Buthaina Shaban, who was representing Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the ceremony, said the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani out of fear of his successful strategy that undermined their plots in the region, stressing Syrians will learn many lessons from the general's life. On the sideline of the ceremony, an exhibition was held shedding light on General Soleimani's life and focusing on his achievements in the fight against terror in Syria and Iraq in the past decade. A year after Lieutenant General Soleimani's assassination, Syrians are clearly keen to demonstrate their respect to his sacrifices for their country. Ceremonies held across the country express the high level of appreciation everyone here has for what the general had offered for the security of Syrian territories. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the Nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez, although in the opposition some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office. While the opposition has hit bottom in political terms, Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Unemployed.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment. So we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government says it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
In the present time, a component manufacturer movement has fortunately been launched with which they are building very sensitive and delicate components for various machines. If they had given them to us in the first place, no one would have thought of building them inside the country. If factory owners needed them, they would go and import them into the country. However, when they cannot import them from the outside, they refer to universities and research centers, asking them to do their best and to build the components for them. Therefore, by Allah's favor and grace, we have managed to utilize the sanctions in the service of the scientific blossoming of the country. This was the third point.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The fourth point is that, as I said before, sanctions have not paid off. That is to say, the enemy failed to attain his goal by imposing them. What is the reason for that? The reason is the important projects that were carried out in the country during the time of sanctions. For example, several thousand knowledge-based companies were established in the country. This is a huge breakthrough. It is evident that the scientific and economic movement of the country has gained its momentum. Before the imposition of these harsh sanctions, we did not have these several thousand knowledge-based companies. Another achievement is the Persian Gulf Star Refinery, which was established by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. It is a great and manifest feat which was accomplished during and despite sanctions. People throughout the world are impressed at this achievement.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will take a look at the major events and news that took place throughout the year across the countries of this vast region.
This year was marred by the COVID pandemic, and the uncertainty it ensued was not only in the subcontinent, but for the entire world. The normal flow of life was disrupted by the COVID pandemic in almost all the societies, and the economic prospects are grim for the whole subcontinent. Wide-ranging lockdowns took great tolls on social and economic status of many people and industries, resulting in unemployment and unwanted migration, as well as nationwide protests.
The year 2020 will be remembered in future history books as the year that one of humanity's smallest enemies hit the entire planet with a shadow of doubt about the future. It impacted the political and social discourse everywhere, and the subcontinent was no exception. The first cases of the coronavirus were reported in the winter of 2020 in most of the countries, and in less than 2 or 3 months, almost all of the subcontinent started enforcing on and off nationwide lockdowns. Uncertainty about the future of the outbreak or possible lockdowns resulted in the bankruptcy and closure of numerous businesses and consequently the unemployment of workers that caused even more financial insecurity for the people. India, for instance, witnessed a colossal migration of workers from cities to their home villages as there were not enough jobs in the cities anymore. As one of the key sources of revenue for most of the subcontinental nations such as Nepal, Maldives or Bhutan, the tourism industry was among the most disastrously hit due to the COVID-19 restrictions.
The World Bank predicts in a report that South Asia's economic outlook is grim as the region is set to plunge into its worst ever recession as the devastating impacts of COVID-19 on South Asian economies linger on. As per the norm of the world, such impacts are disproportionately costly for the ordinary workers as millions of South Asians are pushed into extreme poverty.
India's economy, the region's largest, is expected to contract by 9.6% in the fiscal year that started in March 2020. Regional growth is projected to rebound to 4.5% in 2021. Factoring in the population growth, however, income per capita in the region will remain 6% below 2019 estimates, indicating that the expected rebound will not offset the lasting economic damage caused by the pandemic. The government of Premier Narendra Modi, that was struggling economically even before the outbreak, used the downward trends as a cover to go ahead with its nationwide plan to privatize many industries and implement a wide array of reforms. His initiatives were greeted by nationwide demonstrations as different sectors were protesting for different reasons. Protests against the changes in the agriculture sector are still being held by farmers throughout the country.
Today we are organizing rallies in support of the bond. Here in Calcutta we have also organized. Now we have burnt an effigy of the King of India, Modi.
In late November, a mass general strike was held across India. The strike was organized by 10 trade unions across the country and was supported by the Indian National Congress, the Marxist Communist Party of India, and some other left-wing parties. The strike saw an estimated 250 million people involved, making it the largest in history.
Not only didn't the daily battle against the disease make the tyrants feel less sympathy for their fellow humans, but also the loud global frenzy caused by the pandemic rendered the oppressed even more voiceless, as the news of their daily ordeal were less heard or even noticed. The government of Narendra Modi, which has been facing protests and riots since the introduction of the citizenship law that discriminates against Muslims, even used this opportunity to further suppress the Muslims in the entire country by arresting many high-profile Muslim activists and ordinary civilians under the cover of the coronavirus pandemic.
The suffering of Muslim minorities across the subcontinent have always been among the most underreported issues, but in 2020, stories of their ordeal were further buried under the pile of daily coverage and updates about the pandemic. In Bangladesh, the woes of Rohingyas never abate as they are deprived from the basic human rights. In February, 15 Rohingya refugees died, while another 72 were rescued when a trawler bound for Malaysia sank near St. Martin's Island in the Bay of Bengal.
Unfortunately, we are seeing the situation in Myanmar vis-a-vis Rohingyas is continuing. I mean, they are identified as the most oppressed and most persecuted community. And this is continuing, and unfortunately it's continuing because there is no political will to address this. West and the international community are they've got no political will, and this is really continuing, is becoming worse, not just inside Myanmar, but those who managed to escape the death and the torture and rape. And they are actually living in a very difficult circumstances in Bangladesh and India and elsewhere. And what is really important to recognize is that the fact that there is no political will to address this issue, it's given green light to others to go down the same route.
In September, 24 more people died after a leak in the gas pipeline caused an explosion in a mosque in Narayanganj district. In bloodier waves of attacks against Muslims, Hindu mobs killed or brutalized scores of Muslims in northeast Delhi in late February. Of the 53 people killed in the bout of violence, two-thirds were Muslims who were shot, slashed with repeated blows, or set on fire. The number of such attacks has increased since the Hindu nationalist government is in power.
we are seeing vis-a-vis what is happening in India. Muslims in India are now prosecuted, and there has been the rise of extremism and empowerment of extremism because of their connection to the Indian government, and the fact that they are getting away with murder and lynching of the Muslims. And also we've got the situation of Kashmir. Matters are becoming much worse. I think the international community needs to respond, and the lack of response by international community to address these injustices actually leading to the circumstances that the matter is getting worse. And unfortunately, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And unfortunately, I don't see even the Muslims around the world and OIC and others really responding adequately to this very blatant Islamophobia, and the fact that Muslims seem to be a community that could be abused and oppressed across the world, and in particular in that region, and no one is going to be held accountable.
Just as the riots were ongoing in Delhi, Premier Modi hosted US President Donald Trump in such a welcoming ceremony that it was unbelievable for the lame duck president. The Namaste Trump tour event held in Ahmedabad as a response to the Howdy Modi event in Texas served as a platform for the US president and the Indian Prime Minister to display their friendship and show off a $3 billion military deal.
2020 was shockingly abysmal for many people across the entire planet, but blood and tears are such frequent occurrences in some parts of the subcontinent that nothing can halt or dwindle them, not even in the face of a shared biological enemy. As Amphan and Nisarga cyclones and swarms of locusts kept ravaging large swaths of land across the virus-hit subcontinent, some human-induced hazards, like gas leaks and pipeline explosions, added to the misery of the people on the backdrop of border clashes and terrorist attacks. The most important rivalries of the subcontinent come down to the dynamics of ties between India, Pakistan, and China. And in the year 2020, the heights of Himalayas witnessed a dizzying array of military movements and confrontations as India was engaged in skirmishes with both Pakistan and China. During an aggressive melee between India and China in May, several Indian and Chinese soldiers were at the Nathula crossing and other locations across the Sino-Indian border, including near the disputed Pangong Lake in Ladakh and the Tibet Autonomous Region, and near the border between Sikkim and the Tibet Autonomous Region. Moreover, India and Pakistan escalated their adversary to new levels over Kashmir. More than 15 people were killed along the line of control in their face-offs that are increasingly getting fierier, especially after India's change in the country's constitution on the status of the region. Territorial disputes over the Kashmir region sparked two of the three major Indo-Pakistani wars in 1947 and 1965, and a limited war in 1999. Although both countries have maintained a fragile ceasefire since 2003, they regularly exchange fire across the contested border known as the line of control. Both sides accuse the other of violating the ceasefire and claim to be shooting in response to attacks. An uptick to border skirmishes that began in late 2016 and continued into 2018 killed dozens and displaced thousands of civilians on both sides of the line of control. This year has been particularly violent. The June clash in the Galwan Valley, fought with sticks and clubs, not guns, was the first fatal confrontation between the two sides since 1975, and relations have continued to deteriorate. India acknowledged its deaths. China did not comment on reports it also suffered fatalities. If neither side gives way, the standoff could have destabilizing consequences for the region, If they come to blows again, there is a risk of escalation between the world's most populous countries, both established nuclear powers. Usually, the locust swarms enter India through Pakistan for summer breeding in June or July with the advent of the monsoon. But this year, Indian officials say the pink swarm started much earlier in April because of presence of residual population in Pakistan that couldn't be